Here we are.
We're here.
August 2nd, DPBC. The guest is Jessica Lee, the chair of privacy,
big brain,
security and data innovation at Loeb & Loeb.
Big brain. I'm excited. Our conversation was awesome. It was like sort of rapid fiery. I was in question mode today, so I asked lots of questions, but she had great answers and doesn't necessarily agree with me on some things, which I think is great.
That's the best. not everyone agrees. And
best.
I love her. Like there's an innovation side of their practice group at Loeb, which is really cool. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in the law firms that want to expand the breadth of that practice as the hot buzz words like AI and things happen. Lawyers are all over it.
Agree. I'm a big fan of like expanding this idea of a quote privacy practice into a sort of like data management, data governance, like data innovation, whatever term, where we can actually bring in more experts. And we talk about this a little bit with her, but like, I don't think privacy professionals are well suited to solve all of AI's problems, for example. And so instead of trying to develop more skills and pile on our responsibility for ourselves, I think one of the better plays is to expand the concept of what it is to support a tech company's legal operations and like just incorporate other experts like safety and civil rights experts and, you know, ethicists and all.
One of the things, Pedro, that Meta does and other companies I know for a fact do this too, bigger ones that have these issues at scale, they organically get advice from other communities. Like you've introduced me to professors in Italy, and like there's an academic community. There's an AI based community that's been doing this work for a long time, long before anyone was developing a ChatGPT technology. So Meta and others have been doing that for a while, but it's time for that to be mainstream.
Yeah. And it's also like Meta has the luxury of being able to invest in all of that, right? Like that's most of what my team does is engage with lots of stakeholders with different expertises to try to get, you know, sort of like holistic signal on what we're up to. That's really hard to do when you're a startup. So law firms got to fill that void, right? And so what I love about Jessica's practice is that it's expanding in that direction to meet that demand where a small company just can't make that investment. But it'd be great if companies could go to their law firms and say, hey, like I need more than just like privacy signal here. I need broader stakeholders.
There's a corollary to lobbying and consulting. I think you see like law firms, sometimes they'll have partnerships with consulting or they'll have a lobbying group, you know, in their law firm. Maybe this is the sort of like, in some way, this is the next gen of this needs to be like thought development, you know, around innovation.
Yep. We'll see.
On the tech side.
I mean, Jessica's out in front of it. So hopefully they'll like Loeb & Loeb will show us the way.
Yeah. All right. Here it is. All right, here we are.
We're here. What's up? We did it. Oh, man. Fun time.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We've got Jessica Lee, the chair of privacy, security, and data innovation practice at Loeb & Loeb, joining us today. I have a question about that. What's the data innovation piece? The privacy and security stuff I think we get, but what is that? Does that involve AI or what else?
Yeah, that's supposed to capture the bucket of all innovative uses of data. Because the way our group is structured, like we don't just have like corporate litigation and privacy falls between. We have this advanced media and technology department, which was originally focused on online advertising, but has become the group where all emerging tech falls. So the data innovations is client comes to us, fill in the blank. We've gotten, you know, it's AI. We've got a head device that will track your brain waves. Like we've got a lot of things that fall into our group that we advise on. So that's really where that comes from.
The brain waves. Was that Elon Musk's Musk had that company, right? I forget what it's called. I met the general counsel of that company once and he described it to me and I was like, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. You're just all right. Well, let's dig in and figure this one out. But yeah, that's a bucket for all things. Like we'll just have to figure it out.
Yeah. I think some ideas belong in the ashtray. I think like for me, a brain implant for convenience is not, I'm not interested. No, thanks. I get why by necessity there might be a lot of use cases, right? Like particularly people with disabilities. I'm here for all that, but like
it's true, but my life
more trackable via
right. Sometimes I'm walking down the street and I'm like, I wish I had a way to capture this thought. If something was in my brain tracking it, that would be helpful. But the risk of that is probably too high for the reward. So
yeah, I bet you the police wish that was true too.
Yeah.
Like a searchable device where they could track all your thoughts. Yeah, I'm not really here for that.
Yeah, no. I mean, here's
a point though. But it would be easy to get consent. But I'm bum.
I hate you, Andy. I hate you.
Little inside baseball joke. Anyway, Jessica, was that always like that everything bucket? Was that always kind of like what you envisioned when you went to law school? I'm going to be a tech lawyer, privacy, security, emerging tech. Did you always want to do that or did you start off differently?
No, definitely started off. I mean, I went to law school. I thought I was going to be a civil rights lawyer. I thought I was going to be like the next Johnny Cochran. That was the plan. And, you know, privacy, security, those were not classes in law school. That was not a thing. I didn't know it was even a practice that existed. So that definitely came afterwards. But in law school, I pivoted because I took electronic publishing. This is when like books, I feel like old saying this, but like when books were getting digitized and e-readers. So like I got more into the IP technology side in law school, but it still wasn't privacy yet because I didn't even realize that was an area to practice in.
I don't think it was really. It wasn't until recently. When did you make the shift? Yeah.
When would you say that? I mean, there's people been doing privacy work for a long time, but when would you say it sort of crystallized as a practice? Like, what's the timeline there? Late 90s, early 2000s is when it started. Like, their contours started developing about like what it means. I don't know. I know that I graduated from law school in 2008 and it didn't feel like it was a crystallized practice then, but maybe that's because I was inexperienced.
Same. I mean, I graduated in 2005 and I felt the same way, but I talked to people who were practicing before then. So I do think, you know, in the early stages, you had like, you know, if you were in the US, like hand spam and laws like that, and you had FIPS, you had the concept of privacy that were being implemented. But in terms of being an area that everyone was flocking to, you know, I didn't really see that until like 2015-ish, 2016, that's when, like a little bit predating GDPR, when you start to see the masses moving to privacy as a practice. And that was really the area, that's really where it happened for me. Well, so I started off at Skadden doing litigation, during securities litigation, completely separate, but I was trying to get into more intellectual, I know.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it's great. The plaintiffs are all like the firefighters' pension fund because they're all like these claims. So it's not. Yeah, I had to move out of that. I had to move out of that space. But when I came into Loeb, I found this media technology practice group, and that sounded really interesting to me. And that's where I moved in. And you know, there was privacy work, but that wasn't the full focus. But over time, it's moved to the place where there's really not time to do anything but privacy.
What do you think is like with the introduction of AI and sort of like all of the other interests at play with the wide adoption and use of AI tools? Like, what Andy and I talk about this all the time with other guests, but like privacy is a obvious like interest that needs to be considered in the proliferation of AI. But like, where does privacy sit in the like list of concerns around like particularly Gen AI, but just the proliferation of AI more broadly?
I mean, in terms of the list of concerns, I mean, I would put it up there. I appreciate the arguments that, you know, privacy is not the biggest issue, that there are all these other issues to consider.
That's my argument.
Yeah. I mean, I hear that, but I think if you don't push privacy to the, not to the very top of the list, but if you don't put it at the top of the group of considerations, then we'll forget about it. And obviously when we're talking about AI, when we're talking about data, it's not all personal data, but a lot of it does involve personal information. And also I think the benefit of having privacy as part of the conversation is that privacy has the infrastructure now that, you know, if you're building out an AI practice at a law firm, or if you're building it out in-house, you can leverage what you've built around your privacy program for your AI governance. And I think that's where you can leverage some value. So it's part of it. It's like
my counter argument. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Finish.
I was going to say, like, my counter argument for that is that actually the privacy practice is not the right framework, because like some, and I love this discussion. I have it as much as I can. So like not picking on you, but like, for example, I don't think privacy experts are the right ones to like lead on some of the key considerations around AI adoption, which are like safety. I think safety is a huge one. I don't think my privacy expertise really makes me a safety expert. Like, I think too, like the disparate impact, and like you talked about being a civil rights lawyer, like the civil rights angles around like AI adoption. I think I actually think privacy professionals are not well suited for it, because particularly in the context of the observation of civil rights, in the context of use of AI, privacy can be at tension with like that other interest. Like, for example, if I don't know that you are a member of a historically marginalized group, I can't necessarily protect you. I mean, in, you know, use case and obviously context dependent, but like, so I have to know. But a privacy pro would say that's information we never want to have, you know, this type of stuff. So like, I think there's a tension there. And I worry that like, because there is this interrelationship with privacy and AI, because right now machine learning systems rely so heavily on large data sets to operate, that we're sort of like not focusing enough on the outcomes of the uses of these AI, which can be catastrophic for a lot of people if we're not careful.
No,
much more catastrophic than my privacy being violated.
No, and I agree with that completely. And I don't mean the privacy people, I mean the privacy infrastructure in terms of like reviewing products mm-hmm. before they go out and that kind of thing. I think it's more the program itself, not necessarily the people. I think you need other people and talent, because I agree. I think the key issues are around, you know, safety and civil rights, even intellectual property. Like, those are all key considerations.
Exactly.
And I think if privacy people at the table, they should, I mean, you know, not to break the community apart, but it should be the practical privacy people that understand you do need a certain amount of information in order to make decisions, not the people who think that, you know, you should never share anything, right? Because I think there is a balance there. And so some of the laws that we're seeing now, I think, are creating, have the risk of creating negative outcomes, right? I think that we don't want to see that in AI, because those risks are particularly high. So I think you need to have different voices at the table, but I do think some of the structure of a privacy program will help in the structure of an AI governance program in terms of reviewing these products and identifying these issues and trying to, and you do see things like, you know, we've had to blend a little bit of privacy and ethics with looking at automated decision making and, you know, those requirements coming out of the EU. We see some of that in the US now. So I think there's some of that groundwork, but it can't just be privacy voices who are running these programs.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you said something really important there about like diversity of thought. You didn't use those words, but that's what you were alluding to. I think we need like diversity of expertise. And that's what I'm arguing for, that like even with more information, privacy professionals should not be making decisions about civil rights or about safety, like that weren't just not qualified. We need to bring those experts in. So there's that diversity of thought. But your point about like diversity of thought, even within, you said, I think you mentioned like practical privacy people versus others, like diversity of thought within the privacy profession around AI, I think is really important. And I'll say I was pretty disappointed. I think it was Trevor Hughes or somebody at the IAPP posted a photo on LinkedIn recently, or maybe it was Threads, I don't remember, but of like some AI meeting that happened amongst leads in the IAPP last month. And the panel of leads was described as like, you know, AI thought leaders. And there was not a lot of diversity, visual diversity on that panel, right? And that was really disappointing to me. It was really disappointing to me, because it's like there's a lot of people like you and others that have interesting points of view and diverse backgrounds and diverse life experiences. And we like within the privacy discussion need to incorporate more of that. And I'm just not seeing it. It's frustrating that like maybe I'm just sensitive to the issue, but I don't think we're being as inclusive as we could be. And we're sort of repeating some of the same mistakes of the past. Interested in your take about that.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I mean, look, you see this, I clerked for a judge kind of in between, you know, Skadden and my and coming to Loeb. And that was one. He always had diverse clerks because he said, you can't look at these complicated decisions. It's the Eastern District of New York, a lot of mob cases, a lot of crime cases, in addition to the civil cases. Like, you need to have this diversity of background and experiences in order to kind of weigh in. And so I've always taken that thought with me. And so for anything, you need to have, and I've seen this over the course of looking at multiple, you know, client issues and legal issues over the career, you need to have, in addition to knowing the law, like a practical, diverse life experience to weigh in on potential harms. And so I think what we're seeing is you see the companies who are leading here and the people at those companies. I think you see some women, but not a lot of like other like racial diversity, for example. And I think that's a, miss, particularly when we're talking about the risk of, you know, civil rights and discriminatory harm. You want to have those diverse perspectives at the table who can say, oh, wait, what about this? Or there's this harm that you're thinking about.
How do you like communicate that in the setting of a law firm? You've been at Loeb a long time. How do you communicate that in the law firm setting? Because law firms aren't traditionally known as the most like, you know, the foundational place where new thinking occurs.
That's fair. I mean, I do have, you know, the benefit of chairing the group at the firm. And I, you know, proud to say, I think we have one of the more diverse teams, you know, probably for that reason, because that's something, you know, I look for in hiring, because I do think you need to have those different perspectives. And, you know, I will say our firm chair is supportive of that and has been supportive of that philosophy as well. And I think you just have to always, there are multiple opportunities to drive that message home. And I think you have to look for those opportunities. I mean, like, clients want your advice and they want it like quick and efficiently. So you don't, you know, bill them too much. So you can't drip too much philosophy necessarily into that time. But I think in the way you craft your legal advice and how you describe things, I think you can start to push that message. You know, it is hard as a law firm, but
I think you hit on something really important, right? As in-house counsel, when we hire, like, you're right, we want the answer. We want, you know, we have time deadlines and whatnot. But I think you hit on something really interesting. It's not just about hiring. You are doing it with hiring, but it's also like, well, then what happens after that? You can hire a group of people, but then how are you like ensuring that the method or like the projects that the law firm takes on have diversity of thought happening organically in them? And some of that, I guess, must be like communication directly with your client about that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is just one example. We saw this particularly after, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, and a lot of companies were, you know, had a lot of initiatives, like diversity initiatives around that time. And then that we gave counsel on, and there were many opportunities to say, oh, well, the language you're using here might not work for this reason, or how you're describing this might not work for that reason. You don't always get to do that, you know, in the day-to-day of looking at privacy work, but I do think there are opportunities to show that value of having diversity of thought. And I think that's important. And then just bigger picture, yeah, I think, you know, you hire, but then also how are projects being staffed? What kind of background? And in the space that we work in, it's also, where has someone come from? If I'm a health tech company or from an ad tech company, like, we work with clients who want people who can speak their language because they're trying to get to the point and get to something practical. So I think you have many different places where you can look to show the value of having diverse backgrounds.
Let me ask you a substantive question. So, like, Europe has been really great at one thing around privacy, which is creating rules. They've been really, really, really successful at this. And so, like, the European framework for how companies, organizations, whatever, think about privacy is sort of embedded in every organization I've ever worked at, because the Europeans have sort of gotten out front with GDPR and other, well, let me say it this way, gotten out front with enforcement of laws, because other countries were way ahead of them in actually implementing laws, but maybe not as aggressive about enforcement. So, like, in Europe, we have this, like, perfect storm of, like, promulgation of tons of rules and a sort of pretty aggressive enforcement. And I think that has led to sort of like an influence cloud of like the European way to think about privacy sort of becoming the way corporations think about privacy, because they don't want to be outside of the rules. Do you think that's good?
Do I think it's good that Europe has been the leader for this? Or that the European...
Do you think it's good that like the framework that's sort of like emerging, given the overly aggressive influence of European rules on non-European corporations and how they think about privacy, is good?
I mean, it's hard to say good or bad. I mean, I think because if I look at, if you compare like GDPR to CCPA, there are things mm-hmm. in the GDPR, the European framework, that I think work and work better, right? Because I think some of that, some of it is principles based, is based on, you know, data governance and push data governance. Like when, you know, right after GDPR, say the first year after it went into effect, we got complaints of, oh, well, we haven't heard of the big fines. Everyone was way like salivating for big fines. Like, well, you haven't seen big fines, but internally at a lot of companies, there have been huge structural changes in how they look at things in preparation for these fines. And then obviously fines have come. So I do think that I think that the GDPR model incentivizes good data governance structures. Where I have a problem, you know, with leading with purely the European framework is when you get to, I like the concept of the lawful basis, the way consent is structured, and the way that's impacted things like, you know, cookie banners and how you communicate online. You know, I don't know that that's the best model that we should follow. So getting to a place where the only lawful basis that a company, particularly in the ad tech space, can rely on is consent, and then trying to communicate very specifically how data is being used in those circumstances does not work. Like when I travel abroad and I have to read three paragraphs before I get to a website, like that is not the user experience that I think is either is that I want to have or I think is useful. You know, I think that just leads to swiping it away and moving on. So I think that there are places to improve on the model, but some of it, the fact that we're leveraging some of it, I don't think is a bad thing.
Do you agree with that, Pedro? Like, do you agree with the, it's hard to disagree, in my opinion, with the idea that the GDPR makes privacy programs and people and companies that are subject to those more attentive to privacy related issues. And we could debate forever whether it makes a consumer's privacy better.
Oh, could honestly, we debate we
might,
it? Forever,
yeah, we not even debate, right? We might not even debate. It doesn't. It doesn't. But what it does do is it does create that structure inside companies. So there's an argument at least that it accomplished, you know, quite a bit that way. But that's a really good point, Jessica, about consent and about user experience. And I just wonder, like, do they care? Do they care about that aspect? Not much. I don't think so. I think it's not their problem to solve. It's
right, but it's if your goal was privacy, your goal is giving consumers control and choice and all of those things. You know, is that what's really happening online right now? I don't think so. So then, whose problem is it to solve? And it can't just be, you know, individually on the companies. I think that's an unfair burden. I mean, there are things companies can do, obviously, but these are bigger picture solves. And, you know, my other concern is that you have all these different frameworks popping up, and I don't think that's consumer friendly either, because you have everyone's using different language. Companies are subject to multiple different like regimes. And then you still have the self-regulatory frameworks asserting themselves. So there's just all this information being thrown at a consumer when they operate online, and what are you really getting from that except just like burdened down by information and annoyed?
Yeah, I wonder if like to your bigger question of like, there's no doubt that GDPR was a big trigger for companies to spend a lot more money and put a lot more resources towards privacy programs. That's indisputable. I think you're right. I think the question is that the best way to incentivize that, which is like this threat of a hammer that is hard to understand and hard to interpret? And to Jessica's point, like sort of like includes these required levers that don't improve user experiences, right? And make it harder for users to like navigate, get to where they want to go in a lot of instances, right? By creating lots of friction through means like disclosures and permission asks, right? Is that the best way to think about how to protect privacy, which is to get people's permission at every single step to do every single thing about generally like data use cases that are hard to conceptualize on your phone while you're at the airport. I just, you know, it's just tricky. And so, like, I don't know that that the GDPR was creative enough to allow for like imaginative ways to arrive at, for example, a consent moment, right? Like cookie banners, blocking moments, these types of disruptive actions may meet like regulatory goals, but like sort of doesn't take into account, I think, like how a user wants to experience a service. And I doubt my grandma is really interested in like dealing with hundreds of cookie banners when she visits Spain. You know, like I don't think she's going to love that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think
just to finish my thought, or feel much safer when she sees them all, right? Like, I don't think, you know, my grandma doesn't give a shit. So like, it's just sort of tricky. But anyway, sorry, Jessica, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I mean, I think it's also the lack of focus on consumer education, because you give all these tools, but you don't give enough information to make decision. So like, and I've told this story before. My mom at one point came to me and she said, well, I wanted to buy this thing, but they had a cookie banner on their site, and I don't go to any websites that have cookies. And I'm like, well, you don't go to websites because they all have cookies, you know? And I think
agreed. But think about this consequence right here. Like, think about this analogy. When I get into my car, my car wants me to put on my seatbelt, right? So it makes noises for a while and like flashes things on my dashboard that with red that say your seatbelt's not on, and like all sorts of stuff happens. I'll tell you what doesn't happen. My car still starts and I can still drive it, right? Even though it's annoying me a little bit, I can still do it. What cookie banners and blocking banners do is like, you can't go here. You just full stop. You got to wait. And you got to make a choice right now. And if you don't make that choice, you ain't going nowhere. And so I would argue that the consequences of me not wearing my seatbelt are extremely more severe than any data protection consequence that a cookie banner would try to protect me from. Yet we haven't gone to the extreme where it's a life and death situation, but we find ourselves in this extreme here when we're looking for GDPR consent in Europe, right? Like, I just find that to be an I don't want to use the word outrageous, but like an unhealthy outcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, my personal opinion.
I agree. It's a blunt hammer. And I feel like part of it is like, and maybe a little less so in Europe, but I feel like we're just behind the curve, chasing after what we see as privacy harms coming out of, you know, primarily online advertising, and the toothpaste is out of the tube. So you have all these things where it's like, oh, we're going to have it. We're going to have these big banners. We're going to have these do not sell. We're going to have all this stuff because we're trying to chase this like ball that's already rolling down the hill and it's already so far ahead of us. Like, what are these big things we could do to try to capture it? And I think we're not being very successful with that.
Jessica, you're a big runner. When you're out running, are you thinking about all these things?
I hope not. Please say no.
Or are you like, or is that your unplugged time and you don't think about privacy at all?
Yeah, it's definitely, I'm not thinking about ad tech when I'm running.
Good.
Although I will, good for you. You know, when I train for marathons, I have, because it takes up so much time, I have thought, of, you know, should I try to find a way for someone to like read these laws to me while I'm running so I can multitask? But honestly, I don't think I would be able to survive. So I mean, I run to music. It's the unplugged time, and I can clear my head and then come back.
So you haven't built a client while running?
No. I mean, I have.
Don't make your answer that here, man.
No, I do not build a client. I don't have the infrastructure to build a client while running.
She dropped.
Am I back? Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay. You're back. Now we can.
Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah. No, definitely do not build clients while running. Okay. Trouble for that.
Our system went into overload when you asked that question. And like,
I know.
But you know, Pedro, my story about my old boss that told me he billed for his dreams. Yeah. So like, anything is possible.
Yeah. Billing for your dreams.
That's
Jessica, the listeners can't see Jessica's reaction to the person that filled for a dream. It was shock and awe.
Yes. I mean, I've heard crazy.
I know we got to go through, but like, you have such a big brain. I want to ask you one more like substantive question. So I pick on Europe all the time. Got it. We all understand what's going on there. And I think your point of view is well-reasoned on like what it means for Europe to be in the lead, I guess, as far as promulgating privacy regulations. What's the rest of the world trending like? Like, I hate to put all of the rest of the earth in a one bucket. I think that's not cool. But like, where are other regions in the world trending? Are they trending to like follow Europe? Are they trending in their own direction? Like, what are you seeing in other places? Not the U.S. so much, but maybe like Brazil, India, Africa, more, you know, APAC more broadly. Like, what are you seeing as trends in privacy regulation?
I mean, I do see a lot of inspiration being taken from the GDPR, right? I mean, not everyone is following that, you know, so specifically. And I was actually talking to a lawyer who's based in India, and he's like, well, you know, we would think about privacy differently because we have a community view, right? Like, we're not so individualistic. So this concept of these individual rights, like culturally, don't work, you know, in this particular region. So we think about things, we're looking at it from a different viewpoint. So I think you have some of these cultural influences, which will affect how, what privacy looks like. But you do, I mean, if you look at Brazil, you know, that law mirrors GDPR, you know, fairly significantly. And I think it's become so ubiquitous, I think, in the privacy world that if you're just standing up a privacy regime within a country, you're at least taking some inspiration from the GDPR principles, even if you're not taking all of it. And that's, I think, what we're seeing in the U.S. We're not leading with that, but we are pulling. We're starting to pull from some EU concepts as well. So I think it's going to be hard to escape it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, the good news is we'll be busy. I mean, I think the bad news is, like, I hope we end up with, like, I just, the fact that lawyers are out in front of a lot of this, it's scary to me. Like, when I look at tax regimes around the world, like, you can't harmonize them. I just hope privacy doesn't land there, but it looks to me like we're heading in a sort of like highly punitive, difficult to navigate, always in trouble direction. And I don't just mean for big corporations. I mean for every organization trying to like process user data to deliver a product. And that just doesn't seem like the best outcome to me. But we'll see where it lands. I'll probably...
So doom and gloom. So
I am doom and gloom about it today, man. It's because I have COVID, by the way, and I'm doom and gloom about everything.
Jessica, thanks for being with us. Appreciated the, thank you. The conversation was great.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you so much, Jessica. You can like click out.
Okay, that was really good.
I'll tell you when it's all ready. That was really great. I love that your practice touches on the other bucket. The other bucket is really interesting to me, like to hear in the way you guys are handling all that different new stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you have to. So, and I think, I mean, I wouldn't be able to stay doing this work if I didn't, because I would be really bored. So I'm glad I get to do it. So good to see
you guys. I get it. Awesome.